The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, as promised, we're talking to you right now in Nassau, Bahamas, but you're coming via Orlando. I know there were 10 to 12,000 people at this last conference that you were at. Tell us a little bit about Orlando before we move to the Bahamas conference.
Well, Kevin, I think there's several things that are worth mentioning. It was an excellent conference. We had a fantastic time meeting with clients, McIlvaney Weekly Commentary listeners, the newsletter subscribers, and just a wonderful, wonderful group of people. We had about 140 of our people who showed up to the conference. Out of that 10 to 12,000, Kevin, it was interesting. I had a room that we packed out. Seating capacity was about 175. And there was well over 200 in the room with standing room only. But the scale of that, I think, is worth mentioning, Kevin, because if you think about a conference of very interested investors, people who are trying to figure out what's happening in the world, what's happening with their portfolios, what they can do to either preserve or grow their capital, you have 10 to 12,000 people. And if you take out the 140 people who already know us and would, of course, be interested in the topic that I was speaking on, specifically precious metals, that leaves between 60 and 70 people out of 10 to 12,000 who have even a passing interest in the metals. And I think that is very, very telling, Kevin. It was encouraging to me, and I guess when I say it's encouraging, that probably needs some explanation. It's encouraging to me, Kevin, because for that few people to be interested in metals after a 10-year move in the metals, we're talking about 10 years of an average of 12% gains per year, some years a little bit more, some years a little bit less. It's surprising to me that the general public still has no interest whatsoever in gold and silver, and that to me is a strong indication.
Yeah, from a bull market perspective, David, that's very, very encouraging to the owner of precious metals, because that shows, like you've said many times, that we're definitely not in that third phase of the bull market where shoeshine boys are coming in and buying gold and silver coins. We're still at that phase where the general public is wanting to know how you day trade tech stocks, I think.
I think probably the greatest success at the conference, Kevin, was folks selling software platforms for how to trade your way into millions. Exactly what you just described, Kevin. How can I take my $5,000 in savings and turn it into $5 million over the next 18 months? And not only is it an unrealistic appraisal of how money is made and grown, Kevin, but it's completely unrealistic in terms of an assessment of risk in the markets. And really what it boils down to, Kevin, is people want to be told exactly what they want to hear, which is, you can make your millions without blood, sweat, and tears.
Mm-hmm.
You can do it with a subscription of $39.95 a month to our software package or something like that. So it was interesting, Kevin, if nothing else, from a sociological perspective, and just as an anecdote, I thought I would share that as we get open this morning. The breath of fresh air were the remarkable people that we got to spend time with, both at the main presentation and then in the subsequent question and answers private session with about 30 or 40 people, and then also the consultations which we had with a number of our clients. We were busy for 4 days back to back.
Well, then let me go ahead and reduce this broad scope down to the fine point of, you know, out of 10 or 12,000 people who were looking at software platforms to quickly trade, there were, like you said, this 200 or so people who really were interested in maybe taking a reality check and saying, okay, where are we really? Now let's take that and put a fine focus on that and talk about some of the questions that came out of that select group, that 200 people. I know you did question and answer sessions, both in the general sessions and then also privately when you met clients one-on-one. What were some of the predominant questions, David, that were coming up at the time?
Yeah, Kevin, I think it's important to look at those questions and share them. John Maynard Keynes used to compare the market to, you know, a beauty contest with a beauty queen. And he'd basically say, what you're determining is not who the prettiest girl is, but, you know, the market is essentially betting on who the judges will determine the prettiest girl is. So it's sort of one step removed from reality. The reality of the market, the reality of the economy is secondary in some sense to how the participants are going to bet. So it was interesting with 10 to 12,000 people sort of betting unidirectionally in with great confidence that the economy had already recovered. I opened up the presentation by saying, while I have my prepared remarks, I am very interested in what's on your mind. Why don't you ask a few questions, and I'll include those answers and the questions into my presentation today. The very first question that was asked was this, Kevin. If the economy is recovering, why do I need to own gold, and why would you expect the price of gold to continue higher?
All right, so if the economy is recovering, David, and we don't feel necessarily that that's the case, but let's say it is. If the recovery is truly in action right now, what was your answer as to why a person would own gold?
Well, Kevin, as you pointed out, our case would be that it is not recovering, that there is, on a very surface level, indications of recovery, but when you scratch beneath the surface, and it doesn't take much scratching at all, you find that the real story is nothing like that, that recovery is not anywhere close. And, you know, a lot of that, Kevin, has to do with the discussion of our fiscal status, what is happening on the U.S. balance sheet, the fact that we will, even here in recent hours, Kevin, we've gotten the fiscal year 2012 budget, and it's a blowout. Instead of $1.5 trillion in deficit, we're looking at $1.65 trillion in deficit.
Yeah.
You know, so we're looking, Kevin, at greater headwinds in a time period where we are rolling over 70% of our debt. We're adding to our total stock of debt, not what the CBO estimated at $1 trillion per year, but between $1.5 and $1.75 trillion per year. This is, Kevin, the reality. The economy is on life support, but it sure doesn't appear that the patient is having any problems whatsoever, mainly because government spending has stepped up to the plate and is filling the gap that the consumer once filled.
Sure.
Basically, 10% of GDP disappeared, the consumer went away, and the government stepped in. And something we've talked about in the past, Kevin, you know, what Richard Duncan described as the shift from capitalism to debtism, which was destroyed in 2008, and now we move towards statism, wherein the state plays a greater role in the marketplace and certainly a predominant role in the economy.
Well, David, then, if it is truly a shift from capitalism to debtism to statism, there seems to be, like you said, there's this perception, this numbing that we've talked about in the last few weeks of the body apparent as far as the economic goes. This numbing is allowing people to think that it's a recovery. Let's just hypothetically look at something, David. Just pretend with me for a moment that we truly are in a recovery, that it doesn't grate against your nerves, that we're completely ignoring the facts, but let's just hypothetically say we're in a recovery. Is there a reason or a place for gold if truly a person believes we're there?
Well, a part of the issue with us being in a recovery is that you then have to fall back very heavily on the skill set that the Federal Reserve has. They've created a massive amount of liquidity over the last few years. And in fact, if you look at the total amount of government liquidity provisions and guarantees, since 2007, 50 different initiatives have been put in place. And since 2007, $23.7 trillion has been committed. Only about $3 trillion of that has been spent, but $23.7 committed to hold up the economy. You know, on par with 1932, not by a long stretch. In fact, you know, you've seen the government be more active here than in that 32, 33, 34 period, where the alphabet soups were launched, all the government agencies which came into existence in the FDR period. But you ask a good question. Let's assume that we are recovering. Kevin, there are certainly things that you can point to that would indicate there is a recovery. Auto sales have been stronger. GM reported a 22% increase in January. Retail sales in January were strong, and that's one way of looking at it. Again, with retail sales, if you take out an inflation component, you realize that retail sales actually did nothing whatsoever. But again, I mean, this is me digressing and perhaps deconstructing the recovery argument. Let's stay on track and assume that it is recovering. If it is recovering, Kevin, you really have to have faith that Ben Bernanke is going to take away the liquidity and shrink the amount of liquidity in the system very aggressively. And if he does not, then what we find or will find is an inflation that is out of control. He's running on the assumption that he has the reins in hand and that inflation, like a mighty stallion, is something that he can rein in on and control. Better the inflationary stallion than the deflationary dead horse in his book, which he can't do anything with. But there is a grand assumption there, Kevin. It's a grand assumption, and it would be the first time in Fed history, in fact, be the first time in central bank history anywhere in the world, where inflation was, in fact, fine-tuned, and the Fed was able to contract liquidity at precisely the right moment to prevent there from being a super, let alone a hyperinflation, but more probably a superinflation as a result.
Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. It seems like an anomaly that a recovery at this point, a true, honest-to-goodness recovery with all the money that's been created, could actually become the Fed's worst inflationary nightmare. Is that what you're saying?
It could become an inflationary nightmare. The problem, Kevin, again, with the idea that there is a recovery is that the statistics used to support that notion are themselves flawed. As I mentioned, the retail sales figure, if you take out inflation, the inflationary impact, there really is no improvement in the January numbers. If you are looking at GDP growth, again, with an understatement of inflation, you're overstating GDP. And on top of that, you've got to subtract out the amount of government spending that is taking the place of private sector consumption, basically propped up aggregate demand, Kevin. And again, is it healthy for government to take a permanent place in the economy, you know, larger by 10% of total GDP? Is that normal? Is that healthy? Is that the sign of a true recovery? I don't think so. That doesn't mean that money can't be made. And I think this is the big difference, Kevin. The financial markets can behave very differently than the underlying economy. And this is where bankers, whether it's bank bonuses or bank profits, or the financial sector in general, moving towards some sort of recovery internal to themselves, that is possible when you create the kind of liquidity that Bernanke has created. When you create that liquidity, it's got to go someplace. We're talking about a misallocation of capital. And to the degree that that capital is misallocated, you will see someone benefit because that money is going to end up in somebody's pocket. That's not Joe and Susie Lunchbox, Kevin. That's not the man on the street. It's not the woman on the street. That's not the family out there in middle America trying to make ends meet, experiencing real-world inflation in spite of the CPI lies. So this is the disconnect. We do see the stock market rising. Why is it rising? Is it because of fundamentals which are supporting a recovery in company profits? Absolutely not. It's simply because you've got money flowing from the Fed into the financial system, and it's distorting values.
You know, David, we've talked so often about the negative effects of inflation, but you just mentioned something that's interesting, where the underlying economy may not be necessarily pointing to the way the financial markets react, at least in the short term. So of all the negative effects of inflation, what would you say would be deemed a positive effect, even if it had a long-term bad outcome? What are some of the positive effects of inflationary policy?
Kevin, there is an issue in defining what I mean by positive, because you know there is a positive effect for speculators and short-term investors, you know, because there is this distortion of money going places that it really shouldn't go. And so there is, quote-unquote, money to be made as a result, but it really is of a speculative nature. And ultimately, Kevin, we still have the debts to pay. Ultimately, our debt-to-GDP numbers, when you factor in Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and our off-balance sheet items, are well over 140% of GDP. And if you factor out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the off-balance sheet items, we'll exceed 100% by the end of the year. So we're well beyond the Reinhardt and Rogoff threshold of 90%, wherein the red lights are going off and you've got caution signs everywhere. The economy is, in fact, in an ugly place. But again, that doesn't mean that money can't be made because of misallocated capital because of these liquidity pushes. That's what we're seeing, I think, Kevin, show up in the commodities markets. That's what we're seeing show up in the emerging markets to a lesser degree now.
David, you know, I've been to carnivals in the past where, you know, I get suckered into, you know, playing the darts game where you throw the darts at the balloon and, you know, most guys think that they can do either shoot hoops or throw darts. And so, you know, you pay your buck and you throw the dart and you pop the balloon and they're like, wow, and they hand you some little thing that's probably worth a quarter. And then you pay another buck and you throw the dart and you just keep doing that. And by the time you're into this thing, you may be $25 or $30 into a game where you're winning an animal that probably, a stuffed animal that probably costs the carny all of $3. And in a way, you may feel like you're coming away with something. But as far as what was being taken away to get that animal, you've lost $30 to get a $3 animal. Is that a little bit like what we're talking about here, where we feel like there's recovery, we feel like these things are occurring, but you were talking about the government stimulus actually is making up far more than positive effects of GDP right now spending as far as the consumer goes?
So if we're talking about the positive effects of inflation, Kevin, because it is stimulus, which is artificial in nature, I think you have to question the enduring nature of it. And what is its long-term impact? That's where it becomes much more questionable. We had many questions, Kevin, while we were at the conference, which related to the direction in particular markets, whether it was gold and silver, the dollar, emerging markets, lots of questions there, U.S. equities, bonds, municipal bonds, things of that nature. Number of questions which related to, you know, a reduction strategy. These are people who, at least of the people who attended that we knew and had relationship with before, they were interested in a reduction strategy in their metals positions on a 3 to 5 year time frame. Not today, but as the market matures and as gold and silver see higher prices, they wanted to talk about our plans and our strategies, what our organizational strengths were, and what we've been discussing with clients now for a couple of years, in anticipation of a transition in the marketplace. Again, not here today, but something on the horizon.
David, that seems to be one of the things that distinguishes you from a lot of the other precious metals dealers at these various conferences around the country, because you have a tendency to want to start talking about when to sell their gold, oftentimes before they've even bought their gold. For the new listener, for the person who's not familiar with the reduction strategy, could you just give in short order a little bit of what you tell these audiences as far as what to do when it's time to sell some of the gold?
Yeah, and Kevin, that's certainly in the context of, you know, what we think is the market direction for the precious metals. We'll look at some of the other asset classes in question too. But for gold and silver, we remain in a bull market, Kevin. And the notion that CNBC and MSNBC and the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times and the Economist have written about with great frequency, that the bull market in gold is near an end because it's in a bubble stage and there's so many people in that trade and it's such a crowded trade. Kevin, I think they just need to go to the money show with as writers. They need to do a little bit more due diligence in terms of the man on the street and the investor on the street out there trying to make these decisions. There's virtually no one interested in the metals. And it really was surprising, Kevin. I would guess that if that kind of a financial conference was held in Europe, in the Middle East, or in Asia, you might find something very different in terms of interest. But I don't know. I've seen other reports, Kevin. Recently, Mark Faber has written that he'll ask investors here, there, and everywhere. It was recently at a conference in South Korea, and he asked out of 1,000 people, who owned gold today? And two people raised their hands, Kevin. So, I mean, again, this is hardly a crowded trade. If you're talking about an investor with whether it's $100,000 or $10 million, very tepid interest at this point. So, again, we see gold as sort of in the second of three stages, Kevin, with it maturing probably over the next 5 to 7 years, maybe on a shorter time frame, maybe even on a little bit longer time frame, depending on how many people come into the demand side of the equation. We know that supplies are even more limited today, Kevin, with mine supply continuing to taper off, even while some demand is increasing here and yon. And it'll be interesting to see what happens when your average consumer decides that they want to own a few ounces of gold or silver. But you're right, Kevin, when we talk to clients, it's with the idea that we want them to see the end from the beginning. Making the decision to invest in any asset class entails a very thorough process of, what am I going to buy? What's the reason why I'm going to buy it? And is there a time and a place that it makes sense to sell it? What would be the environment? What would be the background information that I would need? If I'm wrong about this purchase and it actually goes down significantly, is there something that I should consider as an exit strategy as a means of preserving capital? In other words, Kevin, we just embrace the client's perspective saying, don't you want to know when it's time to sell? And, you know, being a full service company certainly helps with that, being on the asset management side and having an appreciation for equities, for bonds, for foreign currencies, for basically your traditional asset classes. Gold and silver for us is an asset that we understand sort of in a larger context.
Okay, so David, that being said, because of course you never tell a person to put 100% in any one direction. In fact, it takes me back to the triangle where you have it broken into, you know, three different mandates. One is a preservation mandate, one is a growth mandate, and of course one is a liquidity mandate. What that does is that brings the attention to the other markets. Could you just in short order give an idea of what direction you think the various markets are going? You mentioned municipal bonds, you mentioned equities, you mentioned the emerging markets, of course the currencies, and then you've been talking about gold and silver. So take your pick, the order that you want to take them in, but those are all asset classes that I think people would like to have your read on right now as to where you think they're going.
Kevin, let's start with U.S. equities because I think that's where there's the most confusion with the introduction of liquidity, QE1 and QE2. With the accommodation that the Fed and the Treasury have provided to the marketplace, the stock market has responded very strongly to the upside. And I think that may continue for some time, but that's the problem with artificial stimulus. You have no idea when it runs out. It is literally, we today are running on fumes. The question of when we simply run out of steam altogether, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I really don't know. But the reality is it can continue in this vein. And certain market participants are factoring in the inflationary impact and trying to hedge themselves by owning equities as a partial hedge against inflation. My own view, Kevin, is that we should look at the corporate managers and corporate executives who run these businesses. And it's still astounding to me that in any week in the last six months, you've had corporate execs jumping ship. And not on a small scale. With great frequency, we've talked about the buying versus selling in these companies, those ratios, and they remain off the charts.
So corporate executives are still selling more shares than they're buying of their own companies.
I think they realize, Kevin, that the economic headwinds have not gone away. I think they realize that their businesses are not, in fact, in recovery. And they're doing everything that they can personally to clean up their own balance sheets. So selling off equities as they're being driven to higher prices by the current lemmings in the market, given this is an opportunity for them to take some profits and pay down debt. If they've got a third or fourth or fifth home, which many of your corporate execs do, then guess what? They want to pare down that debt and own them outright. Mm-hmm. If we shift over and look at the liquidity mandate there, Kevin, in our perspective triangle, the dollar is you could argue, due for a rally. Whether it ever gets one or not is something that remains to be seen. The dollar has been weak relative to the Japanese yen. The dollar has been weak relative to the Swiss franc. The dollar has been weak relative to a handful of currencies. And we'll have to see if 2011 doesn't hold a rally in the dollar. Not on the basis of fundamentals, Kevin. I think as we look at the balance sheet of the U.S., it's something that is insolvent. So, you know, again, we're talking about short-term versus long-term trends. Short-term, the dollar could rally. Long-term, I think it pays a severe price, with a 30 to 40 or 50% reduction from these levels.
Well, and wouldn't a dollar rally actually be partially because of the weakness of the other currencies that it's being based on? I mean, Europe is not out of the woods yet, and that's one of the major currencies that weights the valuation index of the U.S. dollar.
Well, that's correct, Kevin. And when we look at the emerging markets, also as an asset class that people were asking about at this last conference, Kevin, if you look at the underperformance of most of the equity markets throughout Asia in the last 6 to 12 months, I think you have a telltale, Kevin, there. They were overheated on the upside coming into 2008, never fully recovered, and remain anemic in their growth. And that's in spite of a massive amount of liquidity which has been thrown into the market. If you look at how tepid the response has been in the Shanghai Exchange, Kevin, just as an example, with the trillions of dollars which the Chinese government has provided to the marketplace, I think it's very telling. I think it's very telling, and it says to me, if that's the best you can get for the equivalent of a $4 trillion stimulus,
right?
$1 trillion in actual point of fact, but on scale with a $4 trillion stimulus here in the United States, given that their economy is one quarter the size. What you're really talking about is a market to run from, run away from as fast as you can. The story of the emerging markets, Kevin, is a story that will continue to emerge over a 15 to 20 year period.
Right.
Difficult to play the patience game as an investor. Emerging markets will be very rewarding if you've got 20 years to wait. I think they can be very punishing if you want to stick around for another 12 to 24 months.
That's been one of the points that Stephen Roach has made in the past when we've interviewed him. Stephen Roach is very bullish on China and Asia in general as a potential. But again, he said patience, just like you did.
Kevin, I think transitioning to municipal bonds, you know, I think that's an area that has been sold off very heavily with concerns of faults, with concerns of bankruptcy, with concerns, you know, basically the same kinds of fiscal woes that the federal government has, the state and municipal governments have as well. And the difference is they don't have a printing press. Having said that, we've seen a severe decline in those municipal bonds for probably 18 to 24 months, Kevin. We've encouraged clients to limit or eliminate exposure to municipal bonds. They've been sold off severely. I would guess that over the next 6 to 12 months, they may see a recovery in value. And our encouragement to clients is that they take the next 12 months, and if we do in fact see a recovery in value in the municipal market, sell into that strength. Exit any large municipal positions at this juncture, because just like the federal government issue, Kevin, the state and municipal issue doesn't go away.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned this in the context of my comments, but if you take the state of Illinois and fired every state employee, Kevin, where you basically have no current cash outflow to pay employee salaries and whatnot, you would still have in the state of Illinois a $5 billion annual deficit.
Wow.
Because of all the pension liabilities and medical liabilities to former employees of the state. So, Kevin, I mean, this is, again, the municipal issue is not something that goes away. You may see a dead cat bounce in the muni market, and then I think you have to still face the music when we get into 2012 and 2013. So I would be aggressively cleaning up a muni portfolio should we see a recovery here.
Okay, well, that takes us then to the people who actually can print money. Talked about municipal bonds not being able to be funded with printed money of the state because the state can't print. But the United States can print. And so that takes us to government bonds. What's your thinking on long-term, mid-term, and short-term bonds? Maybe you could explain that a little bit and where we're going from here, yield curve perspective.
You know, when you look at the bond market, Kevin, you have to wonder how many hats exist and how many rabbits can be pulled out of them. The bond market and the currency market have been a real question mark. What's going on there? How do we understand it? Is there something that will allow us to preserve reserve currency status and the IOUs which we've issued, can we maintain them? Can we actually make payments on them? Will we ultimately pay our creditors back some value, full value? These are all questions that swim around in the backs of our minds when we are contemplating the U.S. Treasury market particularly.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin, I think when you look at the bond market today, it is worth looking at our current liabilities, you know, north of $20.7 trillion. And our total unfunded liabilities, which bring us closer to $70 trillion. And you certainly don't see those liabilities showing up as a weighty issue when you look at current yields. They do not factor in the risk of default. They do not factor in anything at all, really, when you're looking at 4.5, 4.6 on the 30-year Treasury.
Sure.
Kevin, you and I both know that we've lived beyond our means as a country for the better part of 40 years. You could probably trace that date back further, but at least the 30 to 40 years of the last credit cycle, we've lived well beyond our means.
Mm-hmm.
And so to look at the bond market today, Kevin, it is the way that we have supported our lifestyle. It is the way that we have maintained dominance on the world scene. And you have to assume that a capitulation of the bond market would be really a sign that we've reached the end of the things that we've taken for granted for many, many decades, whether it's dollar reserve currency status, the U.S. equity markets being the most liquid and deep financial markets in the world, some of these things could begin to be called into question if the bond market collapsed. You have to know that the Fed and the Treasury will defend that market tooth and tongue. And I just want to tie this into another question that was asked about IRA assets and whether or not the government would confiscate or utilize IRA assets to prop up the bond market. My response, I think, took several people by surprise. And it's basically that I don't believe the federal government will utilize IRA assets to do that because they're yours, they're mine, they are quote-unquote self-directed, they are the individual retirement accounts of individuals all across the country. And when you begin to toy with those things, I think you create a lot of, shall we say, political volatility. That I don't think they can afford to do. But what they can afford to do, Kevin, is capture $15 trillion from the pension funds and do so as knights on a white horse. We've suggested this in the past, Kevin, but it's becoming much more crystal clear to me that the bond market will ultimately be defended with a very large resource to back it. And interest rates could very well be defended at low levels and prices propped up in the bond market well beyond the time frame that would be natural or normal. With $15 trillion worth of a war chest. And I think, Kevin, that's where you look at the pension funds and with some volatility in the stock market, if you assume sort of a step sequence, first shoot a drop, maybe a 10, 15, 20% correction in equities, which creates an even greater problem with underfunded pensions. Then, Kevin, I think the government has an excuse to come in, blame pension fund managers for mismanagement. Whatever the scapegoat is, whatever the justification that's given, they will plead their case with pensioners saying you can either have 40, 50, 60% of your pension as it is on track to give you now, or we will guarantee 100% of your pension, but we do need the $15 trillion in assets to manage appropriately.
So that would be done in the form of some sort of an annuitized payout, David? Is that what you're saying, where they would give you a longer-term guarantee as long as those pension fund monies would go into Treasury bills?
Kevin, it's exactly what happened with the Social Security Trust Fund. It got spent on whatever it needed to be spent on and got turned into a long-term liability. They captured a present asset and turned it into a long-term future liability. For them to do that, I mean, this is the government doing what is normal to them. I mean, theft is not new. You have to do it under the right guise, and there has to be enough desperation to get away with it. And I think the pensions are the perfect place where you can actually justify it, but where they'll actually be able to justify it. But a reason I mention it, Kevin, you won in answer to the question of are IRA assets at risk, I would say no, they're not. Not up or until pension assets have already been taken. And then we might revise our view on the vulnerability of IRA assets. But the pension assets are the low-hanging fruit, and that's what would be grabbed first, Kevin. But it has huge implications for the bond market because I think you could spend quite a few of those trillions in supporting the bond market. And again, distorting the notion of risk or the indication of risk in interest rates in the long-term treasury market.
So in other words, it's a form of carry trade. It's basically saying we can keep interest rates unusually low to stimulate the rest of this economy as long as there are funds, like you said, the low-hanging fruit, as long as there are still funds that we can force through the machine. You know, we've talked about the need to sell debt worldwide. But in reality, David, we've grown less and less dependent on international buying of our debt, at least through this crisis, because we've just been buying our own debt with whatever assets or what look like assets that are hanging around. Now, with that being the case, of course, there's an end to that game. And that takes us finally back full circle to where we started talking, gold and silver. The direction for the market in gold and silver this year, it's something you haven't really addressed necessarily. We've talked about the long-term direction. But what are your thoughts about the market as we sit right now?
Kevin, to the degree that the government defends the bond market, I think they have more ammunition than the quote-unquote bond vigilantes do. And the assumption is that the long end of the curve will steepen and you'll see interest rates spike. This is the devil's advocate position on a spike in treasury rates, which I think would be normal and natural at this juncture,
right,
but could be contained. If they're willing to defend the bond market and keep long rates down, mid to long rates down, I think the bond vigilantes really take on a different complexion. And instead of you seeing high interest rates and low bond prices, where that market becomes utterly manipulated and a non-market, I think you see the same sort of vigilanteism show up in the gold market.
Hmm.
If you don't have interest rates indicating real risk in the bond market, it's going to show up someplace else. And that's where I think you see gold and silver as a barometer for instability, a barometer for insolvency, a barometer for inflation, a barometer for a lot of things, Kevin. And I think you could almost consider the gold market and gold investors to be the new bond vigilantes.
So, David, let's say we're looking at gauges on a dashboard, okay, and the bond market is one gauge of rising risk in rising interest rates. And then we have another gauge that's the gold price, but it's actually probably one of the smallest gauges on the dashboard. What you're saying is better to artificially manipulate the big gauge, the bond market gauge, the interest rate gauge, and go ahead and let that gold gauge spike, because not too many people are actually paying attention to that. Is that what you're saying? It's robbing Peter to pay Paul, but nobody's paying attention. Nobody's paying attention right now to one of the gauges.
Well, I think you're exactly right, Kevin. That brings us full circle to the original observations about the Orlando conference and the fact that investors today could care less about the direction of the price of gold. After 10 years of a sustained bull market, it really factors in as irrelevant in their minds. It's not something they've had interest in, nor will they in the future, until it's something that they're forced to purchase by necessity. You know, Kevin, next week we have Mark Faber on our program, and I'd like to quote something that was in his recent newsletter, a quote from Joseph Schumpeter. He says, "The modern mind dislikes gold because it blurts out unpleasant truths." I think, Kevin, that's essentially why you have investors today still tied up in a world of hope, which is normal. It's human.
Mm.
And I think, Kevin, that quote goes a long way towards explaining why people neglect the gold market, because it is unpleasant to consider the reasons why gold has moved higher in the last 10 years and might continue to over the next 3 to 5 to 7 years. So, Kevin, it's more of a psychological blindness. It's something that people don't want to come to terms with, because it means that the world we live in is not quite as stable, safe, or beautiful as they want it to be. I certainly agree with them. I'd like to see it more stable, more safe, and more beautiful, and maybe we will see those transitions in the next 3 to 5 to 7 years. That's been our contention, Kevin, and that's one of the reasons why we're here in the Bahamas today, Kevin, is to look at things from a global perspective, looking ahead, exploring different ideas as we consider transitions away from the metals in future years with a very global perspective. We look at asset management and have to consider the direction that the world is going from a demographic standpoint. We mentioned earlier that emerging markets we consider to be a huge bull story, just something whose time has not yet come. To be early on that theme has been painful. Fortunately, it has not been painful for us, nor do we intend it to be. So, Kevin, we're here in the Bahamas considering, you know, what it means to be a participant in the global financial markets, looking at asset management, an individual's lifestyle in an international context. That's what we call our inner circle briefing. We've joined our partners from Switzerland, from BFI Wealth Management and BFI Consulting for an excellent 2-day seminar. And perhaps next year some of our listeners would like to join us. We have a packed house this year and look forward to the audience next year.
Well, David, I know you're heading to one of those conferences right now, so we'll go ahead and wrap it up. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. Give us a call, 800-525-9556, or look us up on the Internet at any time.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.